From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 739, The Evolution of AI with guest Amy Boyd. Recorded Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Today, my guest is Amy Boyd, who's a cloud advocate at Microsoft, having obtained a degree in computer science, completing a research project in natural language processing and machine learning. And Amy is passionate about data science and machine learning, and her roles at Microsoft have allowed her to work on many different areas of data science, as well as working on projects with customers around the globe. Her role as a cloud advocate is to help developers to learn, engage, and build at Microsoft AI's platform. Amy creates and delivers content online and in person and works with developers to provide the best product experience for them. Although, I guess I think the in-person stuff is tough these days.
Yes, I was going to say I should maybe update that. That also makes me sad. In person. I wish.
This is the longest stretch I've been home in 20 years, and I am really enjoying it. More than I thought I would.
Yeah.
I'm almost thinking it's going to be tough to get back on the road.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there are pros and cons, right? Like, I'm healthier than I was. Mm-hmm. Like, I probably eat at better times and healthier food and stuff like that because you're not just grabbing bits and bobs.
Yes.
Not having jet lag is a win as well.
That's been my joke for a long time, that I've been jet lagged since 2001. Turned out it was probably true. You know, my Fitbit sleep scores jumped up about 3 months into being home. And it makes me think I may not be able to go back. Like, now that you've slept that well, it's hard to give that up.
That's brilliant. I was going to say, but oh gosh, I miss speaking to people in person and just, you know, those side chats at conferences and getting to know people in person as well is always good fun. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see what comes in the future.
Well, and through and through immersed in artificial intelligence, although I find I'm always vaguely repelled by the term. Maybe it's just the contrarian in me that every time I see a term like that, I always play with antonyms, like, does artificial stupidity work? What is that?
It is, it's heavily used, isn't it? Artificial intelligence. I remember a startup, someone in our startups team that I work with really closely, gave me like a fact that said like X amount, and it was like a huge percentage of startups add AI or blockchain or something like that to their descriptions, when actually very, very few have any kind of form of that technology based in it. And I was like, it's certainly out there and people hear of it, but do they know what it means?
Yeah.
That's what always comes to my mind.
How do you define it? It's such a tricky term.
It is such an umbrella term, isn't it? I always think of artificial intelligence as thinking a bit more about something that can be deemed to act intelligent, something mm-hmm. that helps with efficiencies, something that is almost easy to work with. I love that there's like a phrase, isn't there, where it's like any incredible new technology all of a sudden then becomes like buried into our everyday lives and it becomes indistinguishable, or like new technology comes indistinguishable from magic, people say, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's Arthur C. Clarke's line, right? Any sufficiently advanced how technology becomes indistinguishable from magic. And of course, Arthur C. Clarke created HAL. All right, for 2001, A Space Odyssey, which I think is the first time the regular human ever heard the term artificial intelligence, and then it promptly tried to kill everybody.
Yeah, and there were so many predictions, right, in the past mm-hmm. that we would hit, you know, artificial general intelligence, for example.
Right.
By these points where, well, artificial strong AI is a held term, isn't it, for if computers were conscious sort
right.
of thing. But even just, you know, thinking about, yeah, like can something solve, you know, an array of different problems? Whereas I don't know, I feel like AI at the moment is very good, very, very good at one thing.
Yes.
You know, it can really ace one thing.
Although there's been a bunch of different things it's gotten good at. My laugh has always been that artificial intelligence is the term you use when the technology doesn't work. Because as soon as it does work, you give it a new name. It becomes vision systems or natural language processing or, you know, pick one. There's a dozen great things that have spun out of what was initially called artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and I think that's why the umbrella term, this AI term, is sometimes confusing for people, because, like you said, you do just immediately think of all the films that you watch,
yeah,
like, you know, and think about that side of it. But realistically, like, AI has just changed its meaning. What we expect of technology in general changes. I think our expectations are so much higher now on, like, what technology, because
sure,
we're just always trying to build on what we've done before. And so some of the stuff that was like really, really early doors in the AI space, I think there's somewhere where I read where it said like, oh, you know, a lot of things at one point in AI history were just given sort of congratulated to computer science in general.
Right.
And we're not kind of coined under the specific AI terms. So that's, I always find that quite interesting. Like, where does the line get drawn? Because computer science as a theory is fascinating. Like, so many groundbreaking spaces there.
Yeah, all on its own. They, you know, irrespective of AI, just the science of computation is interesting and has evolved a lot as well. Where, when you describe the history of AI, like, where do you go? What's the starting point for you?
Yeah, because there is, if you like keep looking into this, and I mean, like, I'm like scaling the internet. Like, I'm no expert necessarily, but I have this thing about history. Like, I just, or is it? I don't think it's about history itself, because it could be really recent history. It's stories for me. Like, history is stories.
Right.
And stories are always how I learn, for most things, and even in tech. So one of the things I like to think about the most is, some people say like, oh, I hate history. It's like, no, like, it's just stories. Like, you think about, I read recently, I've told everyone about this book, a book called Shoe Dog, which is about the creation of Nike, the sports shoe brand. Well, the sports brand, I guess, in general. Great read, if anyone wants to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. And what I really enjoyed about it was seeing the history. Like, I knew the ending. I knew Nike becomes this, you know, huge, incredible, vast company. But reading it from his storyline, from the creator, Philip Knight, his storyline, like, it's just fascinating to see. Like, he said, imagine the time when everyone wears trainers. Bill Gates said, you know, we want a personal computer in every household on every desk.
Right.
Like, and all of these things are totally normal now. Like, I say, you know, just as I turn up to this podcast and take my Adidas trainers off, surprisingly. And so, like, thinking about that, like, it really is, like, it happens. And so for history of AI, you could go so far back, I think. And as I said, like, it relates to computer science. All of this has come from philosophy and computer science and stuff like that. But I think one of the most famous people before there was, you know, this group meeting where they coined the term of AI was Alan Turing, who, you know, talked about the Turing test. He's an incredible gentleman in history for computer science, but actually also the idea, he said, to have speculated about the possibility of creating machines that can think. I mean, that's broad. That is AI, right? Like,
yeah,
you said, but it as a term. It's one of those other broad terms, but the idea that was in, what, 1950, I think-ish, that he probably, you know, talked about this idea, and I'm sure he mulled it over and worked with a lot of people on it. And I think it was, I found like a BBC News article, and it's like in like 2014, computer AI passes Turing test. 2014, 1950. So
right.
What's that? Like, quick math. 64 years, right, later.
Yeah.
And you kind of got to say, like, goodness me, like, to have those, you know, those those research thoughts. That's a bit beyond me. I almost get imposter syndrome at that point.
But the Turing, I mean, the Turing test almost to me seems deceptive. It's like, can you fool someone? Which seems relatively subjective.
Mm.
But, you know, yeah, okay, we've achieved it. But, you know, a good parrot can do that for a fairly long time as well. Presumably, you're better at it than a parrot. But it just doesn't seem, you know, so much of computing is measurable, quantifiable, repeatable. And the Turing test kind of isn't. It just seems so much more subjective. Were you able to fool someone that's a person on the other side?
Yeah. It's interesting you say that. So the first computer, it's controversial because people say like, oh, have we passed it before then? Like,
mm-hmm.
Has it actually passed the Turing test? Like, I think it says it has a 5-minute conversation. And if it can get like more than 30%, of it being mistaken for a human, then it passes the Turing test. And so there's so many things that you could say, no, like that's not quite right. It should be able to hold a, you know, a podcast conversation, a 30-minute conversation or something like that. Or, you know, you could dispute it. And I guess that is also technology in most research areas, isn't it? In general, where you could kind of say, well, have we passed that? But also the idea that, it's kind of misleading is super interesting, right? Because that then takes us on to when the most, like what they call the gold rush, of AI. So after in 1956, John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, all these big names in AI came together at the Dartmouth Summer Research Project. And that's where it's said that artificial was named as a field.
Right.
And after that became this gold rush, right? People were excited about it. Money and funding was being put into research. And then, you know, really, actually, if you think about it, really amazing projects came out of this.
Sure.
Quite early on.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about planning and actions, there's something called Shaky the Robot, who was meant to be able to reason and make decisions, or micro worlds, which is like a blocks world. So that was like early computer vision in some senses.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, maybe not as much what we think of it now, but, and then one of my, I don't know why it's my favorite one, but, around natural language is Eliza. Eliza was a framework technically, but Eliza had a part or a script, they would call it. They'd do multiple scripts, where she was like a psychology,
like a therapy program. Yeah.
And so, you could almost deem her the first chatbot, which is pretty cool as well.
Cause
like now
is funny. Yeah.
In businesses, chatbots are like, you know,
they're
so
a thing.
Popular.
Absolutely.
And so yeah, Eliza's an interesting one, right? So many critics around that, but you know, maybe there was even the first kind of idea, should we be doing this?
Yeah, that sort of shift to the threat of is this bad? Because it did occasionally make statements that seemed like a therapist's statements. You know, how do you feel about that? That those kinds of things that are a kind of psychological therapy. Without necessarily knowing the intent of any of that, because we still don't think there's any consciousness in there. It's just repeating back the words you said, which turns out it's an awful lot of therapy.
Yeah. I mean, it was pattern matching, right? And that works for a lot of different things. That's great. But it was interesting, like, that, you know, it was even the, I think I read somewhere that said, like, even the creator's, like, secretary or something got really, you know, invested and close to this chatbot, you know, does that start, you know, pulling out warning signs? I mean, ethics in AI is a whole.
Isn't this also a human tendency to anthropomorphize? Like we see faces in tree trunks and on toast and things, right? Like, as soon as the software did anything interesting, you gave it a name, like and you gave it a sense of self that only you were perceiving. It's still just a bunch of technology.
Yeah, interestingly, that is like one part of the history of AI as well that I found, where it was kind of like after the second winter, which I think everyone just calls it like the AI winter, but there's actually been a couple of them.
So what was the first one before we get into the second one?
So obviously big gold rush, right?
Yeah.
You know, everyone was excited. I think it was around 74 to 80. Funding starts to cease, right? Optimism, raised expectations. Were things scalable? Could they work on, you know, bigger problems? How do we get the right compute power and infrastructure and stuff like that? Where are we going with this? Is it useful?
Right.
That kind of thing.
And you said this already, but there was a bunch of good tech that came out of it. A lot of those coordination optimization systems came from that. You know, that is the wave of robotic construction and like automobile building, things like that, all come from that era. But new tech sort of stops for a while.
What's that quote that they use? They say, those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it, isn't it? And it's almost that, where I'm like, when I was looking into this, like I spent a bit of time, I was putting together a session, ironically for a future looking conference, but I spun it on its head and decided I was going to talk about the past. But it was kind of this thing that where you say, well, natural language processing, like that is where we have come now. Like, I mean, recent things are around some of the new language models and what they can do are incredible. Eliza did natural language processing.
Of a sort, very different from today. I even think about the original voice recognition boards in the late 80s, the Dragon Naturally Speaking, so forth, where you had to train them. You had to say certain phrases over and over again. Like, we had natural language, quote unquote, for quite a while, but it wasn't good for a long time.
Yeah. And so like thinking about, these things like have happened and knowing that that is the case does make you think like this stuff takes a while to become what it is now. Like we should really celebrate the fact that all of this research is coming together now at what feels like an optimum time. And we've started putting this stuff in production. This stuff is much more, it could be considered weak AI, I guess, but it's obviously not artificial general intelligence. But there's a lot where we're finding a lot of use in real life, and things are landing in systems. I mean, my first one always when people say AI, I'm like, why do we always forget that search engines were an incredible step in AI? Search is a form of ranking and AI, and ranking via relevance and understanding language.
That was the basic description of what a good search is versus a bad search engine. A bad search engine took your literal words and searched on only those words. And you think back to the early days of the internet, where and let's face it, it's Google. Google dominates. It's the ability to imply what you actually were looking for beyond the word you typed in.
Yeah, I don't think I ever had as much of appreciation for search engines until I actually had the opportunity as an intern at Microsoft to work at Bing.
Oh, wow.
Microsoft search engine. Yeah. And I went in London on the auto suggest feature. So, you know, when you type into a search engine and it comes up with suggestions of what you might be looking for. And we were like the back end team, and then like the front end team was in North America. And so I learned a lot about time zones then, which I'm so lucky for, because now my whole life is time zones. but it's the total respect I now have for search and the amount of work and interesting innovations that go into it. Like, I remember at the time talking about like petabytes of data, and I was like, I don't think I'd ever heard that term before. Whereas like it really is like it was a huge big data AI, production system that, everyone around the world depends on. And that just lit my fire. That's truly like what got me, I think, into the space. I was just like, this is unbelievable. Like, this is where I want to be right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And Amy, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. This episode of Run As is brought to you by the new Virtual Dev Intersection and SQL Intersection Workshop event. If you've ever listened to the SQL Q&A shows on Run As, you've heard the fun knowledge and experience of some of the workshop leaders at SQL Intersection. And for the first time ever, the event is going virtual December 9th and 10th. Go to virtual.devintersection.com to register and check out the amazing lineup of workshops. And there will be great keynotes from Scott Guthrie and Charles Manana, and the workshops cover topics including Azure, .NET development, as well as SQL Server-related materials. Spend a few hours and go deep on important topics at virtual.devintersection.com. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Amy Boyd. We're talking a little bit about where AI has come from, and so these sort of early stops and starts. You did mention the second winter. So there was a second gold rush after the initial sort of shutdown?
Yeah, a little bit. I think, interestingly, there was this whole conversation between what they called scruffy and neat forms of AI. Scruffy forms were probably now what we think of. Like, there was an aim around scruffy forms at the time saying, like, we can't possibly, you know, teach computers to understand what's in images because we don't really know how to explain a computer what's in images almost. Sure. And it's kind of thinking about that side of it. Whereas neat AI would be kind of considered more what I now think of as like traditional machine learning, which is really strange, but you know, naive Bayes approaches or Monte Carlo, you know, where it all goes straight down to the functions sort of thing and mathematical.
Seems very more statistical, mathematical, algorithmic. Mm. So what is scruffy than what? Neural nets?
Yeah, it sounds a bit like it. I couldn't dive super deep, but it sounds like at the time that was kind of it. It was, you know, really saying that we need to approach this differently. And maybe that's the sense, right? If you think of neural networks or deep learning now, the idea that it chooses the features that are most important, and calculates all those different weights, for example, in a network compared to, like supervised, you know, traditional approach where I will tell it what I think the features are in some senses, or the project team, or, you know, that the project requirements will kind of go, well, you know, this is the data that we have. We think this informs the result. I think that's how I've split it. But
sure.
I mean, if anyone out there is listening and has a really good breakdown of this, like, please do share, because I think that's the thing around this. Like, I'm just scouring the internet, reading different bits and bobs and kind of putting it together in my mind from what I know now. But yeah, it's always good to hear.
So, I first heard the terms around neural nets in the 80s, and they didn't seem to go very far. Like, it was almost Eliza-ish, and like, it was interesting for a moment. Like, ooh, isn't that clever? And then it never really got productized.
Yeah. And so that was one of the things I found. So I did not know this at all. Like, so 1980s expert systems, tree-based knowledge systems became the focus of AI because they had such high business impact, right? This was the final proof that, you know, we can get these things into companies and they can save them, you know, X amount of dollars a year, you know, for whatever it is. And, you know, big companies could have them because, you know, specialized hardware and cutting edge, you know, is always expensive.
But and these things sounded like products of the neat, don't you think? The decision tree model, like, it was very mathematical, regular. Everything was precisely programmed. There was no quote unquote training of anything.
Yeah, that's how I interpret it.
Right.
That's how I interpret it in some senses. But that was also when the revival of what they called at the time connectionism was. Now, connectionism now is probably neural networks. Do you know what I mean?
And
at a very basic level, I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. But this idea that there was a form of neural network called the Hopfield net. Jeffrey Hinton just talked about back propagation, and the two areas came together, and connectionism started to get revived in some senses, but wouldn't become commercially successful in that time, which is interesting, because that's when you hit the winter, right?
Because didn't Hinton write a paper who basically said this is very cool and it has potential, and we don't have the computing power for it, and sort of put the nail in his own coffin at that point.
Yeah, and that was what probably the second winter was mostly about,
right.
Specialized AI hardware. You know, I can't even imagine how expensive it was. Do you know what I mean? Like at the time,
yeah.
I cannot even begin to imagine what that must kind of be like, but they were too expensive, these expert systems. They were hard to maintain, mm-hmm. hard to update, I'm assuming as well, like, you know, very specialist set of skills. I mean, you know, do we hear patterns now? Probably less on the hardware side because of the cloud. The mm-hmm. cloud is giving everyone access to incredibly powerful compute. But on the skills side, this one triggered me a little bit because I was a bit like, you know, I don't want it to sound like it, but like sometimes you do feel like it's like, you can't sit with us type part of technology. If anyone's seen Mean Girls, like it literally like a gif of that, just that's all I ever think of sometimes. I've had it like sometimes you having a conversation with people in the space and you know, there's so many areas of AI. You can't be an expert.
Sure. Not a chance.
Maybe you can. I can't be an expert.
No, I don't think you can. I think there's too many areas. And when you really talk about expertise too, I mean, you still see this distinct schism between the algorithmic approaches, the sort of predictive analytics systems, so forth, which are incredibly valuable, definitely have a niche and are under the AI umbrella and take very skilled people to do well. And then you have these neural nets, this very scruffy kind of the deep learning models. And it's all about the training data and odd overfitting and like that. How do you hold all that stuff in your head? It's too many different things. And then much less what you actually do with it. Those are core concepts. Now it's like, are you going to do sales prediction or are you going to do vision systems or are you going to do natural language processing or, predictive failures? Like, you know, analyzing the breakdown of machinery over time. Like I've seen unbelievable software in that space, but they all have that almost touch of voodoo to it. You hit a point where it's like, then the magic appears that it anticipates replace that now. You've got a 10% chance in the next 3 months of that failing.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so interesting. You said like, how many different areas did you just list off?
Sure.
And so sometimes, when we used to be in person at conferences, like you would do a whole session and I'd be talking about, you know, one particular service in Azure, for example, an AI service, or I'd be speaking about an area or a project that I'd been working on. And at the end, like so many great questions. I love chatting to conference attendees, you mm-hmm. know, about what they're up to and where they're at in their journey. And they would like, it would always be like, you like the word expert, and then someone will come up to you and you'll be like, so I have this like audio project, and I'm like, I've literally never even ventured into that space. I've not had the opportunity, or you know, it's not been a project that's come my way. And and all of a sudden you just feel like you're like, oh my goodness, I'm so out of my depth.
Yeah,
everything is quite specialized. But interestingly, like did that do the industry a good thing? Like the AI industry kind of got like broken down into subfields, I guess, right? Like if you're in vision or conversational AI or natural language processing, or even back where I didn't even realize, but like something like reinforcement learning, for mm-hmm. example, like still heavily in research, but starting to see usage of it, you know, and great projects in certain places. But when I actually studied it, I got a great opportunity. I can only say it was on complete luck, really, rather than judgment. It was called adaptive intelligence when I studied it at university. And it was just the best module ever. Like I absolutely loved it. It was so hard. Everyone was like, don't take that module. Everyone fails. but it was such an enjoyable one. But adaptive intelligence, I realized much later on when I kind of came into the industry, that was reinforcement learning.
Right.
Like that was kind of another segment of these subfields almost of AI.
And now you get into that sort of model of, unlike typical programming where it's like, I have a set of inputs, I write a program to get to a set of outputs. This sort of adaptive intelligence neural net model is, I have a set of inputs and a set of outputs. Now train it to write its own program effectively. here's where I want you to get to. Go do it.
Yeah, and reinforcement learning, I found it so interesting because it kind of like learns for itself. So mm-hmm. I remember my lecturers kind of speaking to us about, you know, the mouse in the maze type approach. So if you put a maze and you put mouse in one corner and cheese in the other, cheese is the goal, that's the reward.
Right.
But the mouse has to like find their way through the maze to get to the cheese. Well, on the first go, they don't know what they're doing. They wander around the maze and then luckily they find it. What about if you put it back to the start and then the next time it gets there a little quicker mm-hmm. and then you put it back to the start and then, you know, 10 times in, it goes straight for the cheese. It knows exactly where it is. It's learned it. That analogy has just stuck with me forever and it sure. really explained these incredibly deep mathematical concepts almost just so well.
So do you see any particular for, like, why are we here now? If there was a winter, what was the third gold rush? Like, what was that? What caused that?
Yeah. Interestingly, you said, like, we put a face on everything.
Yeah.
Or we put a name on everything and we like humanize mm-hmm. Tech in some senses. And that was actually something that came out after that second winter that was, you know, to show real intelligence, AI has to have a body.
Right.
AI has to have like something physical. And I think robotics really probably took off in that space and vision took off again, you know, given that this was now something that could engage with the environment that it was in.
Right.
But I think it was even more like if I speculate on where we're at now, like I said, the amount of compute that's so easily accessible, and the amazing powerful compute that's, you know, specifically designed to work with AI projects or, you know, that kind of thing. Like, we've come so far in that space.
Right.
That's got to help.
So, yeah. And just the ubiquity of the computing, too, because training a model takes a lot of compute. Running a model, nowhere near as much. So, you wouldn't want to own that gear. It's kind of nice that today with cloud, we can rent it by the minute and just give it back when we're done.
Or even the whole, like, edge scenario mm-hmm. that we kind of talk about with AI. Like, now it's getting into, you know, real systems in real life, it's in production. That's when, you know, it's something that, well, we can't always call off to the cloud. Like, what if we don't have an internet connection? Like,
right.
We have to start thinking about how we optimize best. So yes, we leverage cloud compute for this, you know, this immense compute to do this large training workload. But realistically, once that model is created, it's a piece of code then with weights and definitions of what that model looks like to be given new data. And so then we can put that on much, much smaller devices potentially and kind of, you know, there's a lot of work. I've barely scratched the surface sure. on kind of the IoT connection, but there's some amazing stuff happening in that space around being able to bring, you know, packaged models down to tiny devices and have them communicate only when they need to, sort of thing.
And not that I think we're actually working towards artificial generalized intelligence per se. I don't know that that's actually a useful product for anyone. But one of the aspects that I've heard over and over again is you tend to train up a model to a certain point. It's getting a good return and then it stays like that. The interval at which it's not like it's continuously learning. You retrain it on a periodic basis if you think it's necessary.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think for like some projects now, it all depends really on the project and the type of data mm-hmm. and how quickly like the world changes in that situation, right?
Yeah.
As to how much retraining you might want to think about doing. There is a form of online learning, it's called, where you would literally learn after each data point, obviously very, very intensive type of learning.
Right.
But, you know, in production scenarios, potentially, you know, figuring out when you need to retrain and understanding the data. And to be honest with you now, it's all of the piping, if we want to call it that, that you would have to kind of install or build out. It's a whole architecture in the cloud. It's not,
yeah.
It's not one single item. I do often kind of point to that a lot when we build content and I build like, proof of concepts, for example, where you're kind of saying like the AI is just one part of a much bigger story. To have this thing really work, we have to first think about the data.
Sure.
Like, we're feeding it the data. Like, are we feeding it the right data? Could we have more data? Could we have better data? Is our data biased?
Yeah.
Is our data skewed?
Isn't the answer to all those questions yes, inevitably?
I'm not sure there is like a one single answer almost to them. They are questions that everyone is still trying to figure out. I think it's understanding your data. Like, do you understand the problem? And I had the opportunity to chat with a data scientist at Microsoft on a stream recently, and she said, like, working with domain experts is the only way that this can truly be useful. Otherwise, you just go down, you know, almost like rabbit holes. Like, rabbit do you hole really after understand rabbit hole. What this data is,
yeah.
what it means?
And what you're basically doing is turning yourself into a domain expert over time to actually, you know, do anything meaningful. It does seem to me that this new ascent, this new gold rush, is a combination of cloud and social media, because it provided so much data.
Yeah, or just data, right? Again, like, yeah, social is, there's so much data going on social, right? But also our devices, they're with us constantly. Like, I'm attached to mine.
Yeah, well, everybody is, right? We are all cyborgs now. We all have a digital extension to ourselves. The only reason it's not on the inside is because A, that's a little gross, and B, it impairs upgrades. But you see the reaction of someone who loses their phone. It's like they lost an arm.
But it has everything on it, right?
Yes.
Like, you pay with it. You have all your accounts on it. It's obviously there's so much going on there. IoT, as I mentioned before, a huge one, right? The amount of data that can come from these small devices about our environment is just unbelievable, the amount of data. That tends to become a real question point when you're building AI projects. Like, what data do we keep? How do we store this data? Because if you were to store every single data point of a temperature sensor or something like that, is that a bit overzealous? Like, but do we need it? I don't know. It's like a per project thing, I think, to figure out.
Yeah, there's sort of a resolution level where, is this relevant or not? But it seems to me this latest ascent came with those combination of things. And my best example is comparing the speech behavior in the 80s and 90s to Siri. Like, once upon a time, making voice work was really challenging. And then one day, you know, the iPhone and, you know, the Android phone and even the Windows phone, they all got voice recognitions with various names, and you didn't have to train it, you know, unless you're Australian. It just worked. It seemed like an incredible transformation.
Yeah. And I mean, interestingly, you tap on something there where it's like, it's already trained. I think that's a current pattern, right?
Yeah.
Where we say, pre-built AI versus bespoke AI.
Mm-hmm.
The challenges and the successes in that space almost are, you know, so different. Pre-built AI, things are being democratized so that everyone can use AI. You don't have to be a researcher or you don't have to be a data scientist in some cases now to use some of these AI APIs and stuff like that. That, you know, if I don't have to build a computer vision model myself, or I mean, a big progress was transfer learning.
Yeah.
When I did a bit of work in computer vision, the idea of transfer learning. So, you have a model that's kind of got like general understanding, and then you kind of specify that last layer of the network almost, and you get it to be more specific, and it can then, be trained specifically on that.
The Microsoft and cognitive services, I mean, these are pre-trained vision systems good at recognizing certain things. Sentiment analysis, like, who'd want to try and train that from scratch? But we kind of expect now, I can have an API where I can feed phrases to it, and it will tell me the tone of those phrases. That's kind of indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah. Or like, even thinking, so that was what I actually did for some of my research when I was in academia. So I'm just looking over here to my left, actually trying to remember when I did graduate, 2014. So that year, so 2013, I guess, mostly, I did a lot around natural language processing, and I actually tried to predict the outcome of a TV show called The X Factor.
Oh my.
Based on social media data. Sounds trivial. There was a lot of technical detail to go into. And one of those things was creating a sentiment analysis classifier. now, that project would take me like a day. Like, wow. It's almost disappointing in some senses that I spent so long. And even then, right, I was using like scikit-learn and I was testing lots of different algorithms to see which one performed the best. And data cleaning was the bane of my life.
Right.
That was the majority of the project. It felt like social media data is messy. But thinking now, like if I can just leverage an API call that basically does that and potentially does it better than mm-hmm. what I built, why would I not? Like,
well, and that seems to be the future now, is that we have these modules that do all these things, but we still don't have HAL. But I'm still not convinced that that's even a thing. Like, do you see groups of folks that are genuinely working on an intelligence?
It's not an area I really look into. I think because mm-hmm. I'm actively like using AI technologies and just trying to keep on the forefront of progression in these areas, like, you know, what's happening in reinforcement learning, because all of that stuff is still in research, right? There's still research on pretty much every area of AI. How can we do it better? How can we do it more efficiently? How can we have it be more realistic? How can we solve the problems that we see? Because I think I always say to people, I'm like, oh, you know, it never gives you an answer, machine learning or AI. It gives you a probability.
Right, an approximation. Cases. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I, like, sometimes when I'm talking to people who, you know, maybe aren't technical, I'll be like, like a point in the right direction. Like, we think it might be something like this. I always see it as doing that. It tries to give you more information quicker, more efficiently mm-hmm. than you might be able to do yourself.
But I also think the general public is really struggling with the idea that computers can be uncertain. You know, I think the average person perceives it as a very deterministic machine. And so when the computer says something, you just trust it. And now we're introducing this kind of software with these probabilities, with this uncertainty, and people are still taking them too literally.
Yeah. And obviously there's a lot of, I think that's where AI and machine learning are like being thrown into real life, and people are realizing, like, you know, who's responsible for this? What if it goes wrong? What if we make the wrong decision?
Mm-hmm.
I always stick with having a human in there with the decision making process is key. It's still at the moment. Do you know what I mean? Like, to actually have control, transparency, for people to understand. Like, it's interesting. I always think, again, back to Eliza, like, I have a magnet towards this thing.
Yeah.
The whole thing was that it was trying to act like something. Whereas now, when we talk about some of the principles of ethical AI, especially with conversational AI, like, being honest that someone is speaking to a chatbot.
Yeah.
It's quite important that people know that when they're asking their water provider on the website, you know, I need some help with X, Y, or Z, that they know they're talking to a chatbot and it can default to a human if necessary, sort of thing, you know, to reason with someone or to, you know, get into a more complex problem.
Mm-hmm.
But realistically, those quick questions, oh, I forgot, you know, can I change my password? Can I update my address? You know, all of that, if it can be done, like, that's great for business. It's great for customers. So I think we're seeing a lot in, like, where this stuff is really landing and making a difference to everyone. But you're absolutely right. Like, it leads to expectation again. Like, we've got to be transparent about what it can and can't do.
Yeah. And we're asking people to understand more subtleties, without a doubt.
Mm.
Do you think there's another AI winter coming?
Oh, that is such a... I hope not. I hope not. I'm quite a positive person in general. And so I want to say that we're moving quite quickly as well. Like, if we think mm-hmm. about even just the progression tooling, the ability to... build DevOps processes, or MLOps, it's being called, isn't it? Into these projects. We understand that this stuff, if it's going to go into production and be used, it's got to be working in and be the same approach as we have done for application development. Like, we sometimes make a joke that in the past, like, you know, you would throw across a pickle file or a model file or a Python or R script to your software developers, and they'd be like, what do I do with this to, like, build it into an application? Now I think we've moved quickly in that space to say, you know what, there's a problem here, we need to solve it. Let's look at other parts of tech. Can it help, or do we need something different?
Absolutely. And it is a good progression. Well, this has been really fun, Amy. I mean, it's got me really thinking about, you know, the fact that we are kind of feeling around experimenting these different things, and that we can find value in them, and that it clearly is getting easier to do more, less and less experimental, more and more sort of reliable components, as long as you understand them.
Yeah. And as I said, like, just look into the history. It's fascinating. I don't think there's maybe enough, you know, premise on where some of this stuff comes from and what mistakes have been made before. Like, let's not make the same mistakes again.
For sure.
I think it's been really eye-opening for me. I've really enjoyed, and you know, I'm not at the end of this journey, reading into kind of what's happened in the past and seeing how it's influenced what we're doing right now.
Absolutely. Amy, thanks so much for coming on the show. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.